was hoping.
Let's see. Mr. Rosenblum believed that Osavejic Gonzalez Kulas from several generations ago regarding modernizations of orthodoxy has served as a slippery slope and halakhically troublesome for our own generation.
I just gave you the questions, some suggestions for modernization.
That some of the points that Osavejic was lenient on and towards modernization, whether those are applicable for our own generation.
You asked me something about wrote or said?
More than how those some of the reps, Talmudim and Talmudim's Talmudim, actions, taking some of the things the reps said at the next level. So women's issues, certain issues, let's say, the broader, more interdenominational, tri-denominational, that's really more of a separate issue. I think the question is also, just as Talmudim and Nicolo, when we're going to America, back to America, to serve the Rabbanus, there are issues that come up in the community, and people say, well, the Rav said X, Y, and Z, but should it be taken into account that something might have been said a couple of years ago, and whether there seems to be a renewing of stock?
The examples you gave, there are issues which come into modernization. Cause opposition to interfaith dialogue, for instance, had nothing to do with modernization. He was dreadfully aware, and he expressed this at the time he gave the lecture, which was there, the Prince's confrontation, of a massive contempt by the Christians for Shmat. He was afraid, which he expressed at the time, that parts of the community of Israel were ready for that. He read about mass at the death of a Christian on that Christmas night, covered Israeli TV, watched by the large sub of the community. That scared him. He also felt, as a very deeply spiritual person, that Lo'alach Vazik Yodom, and the community, people need spirituality. They're not getting it, as many of them are not getting it from Jewish sources, but from the Christian sources. He also felt that the interfaith dialogue, just mentioned, it's a good point you mentioned, interfaith dialogue, he once asked me one of the cardinals that he knew, why doesn't favor it? He said, well, listen, there won't be a level playing field. He said, what did you study in your seminaries? Well, we studied our seminaries. We studied halacha, shulchan aruch. Someone can go through, get smicha, but they never have opened up Be'er Levukim. They never have studied theology in a classical sense. The goyim, he thought they knew theology, they don't know theology either, but he said, what you study is all theology. So if we discuss halachic issues, we could come on board, but theological issues would be an equal match. Whether that was a true reason on his part, simply zikr of the kash, I don't know. But he felt there was nothing productive to come of that. And he was very much afraid of segments of the leftist Orthodox community, you might say, and of course some conservatives were very anxious to get the picture taken at the Times, very anxious to reach out and have some kind of dialogue, etc. But that is nothing but modernization. If anything, the opposition to interfaith dialogue was based on the desire not to modernize too much, and to the native traditional act. The Rav has got the questions of being judged by these, the parameters of what the liberal as opposed to more conservative attitudes. was not easily classified. Certain areas he was very, very strict, very narrow. Other areas he was much more flexible. And he was not always totally consistent either. Some things that he wanted were not compatible, either ideologically incompatible or practically incompatible, and he didn't always put all the pieces together to see what the total picture would look like. What people went to yeshivas to come out to Rav Chachamim. He also wanted them to know theology and philosophy, etc., etc. And he sent a letter which was published a couple of years ago. Dr. Belkin, a whole program, which one thinks per se, but surely would significantly reduce the likelihood that the people who sat and heard his shul would come along them as he wanted them to be. And the Nogi Mitzvah Knesses, Tfilas Beit HaKnesses, he was, in certain respects, very flexible. When he was young, particularly later on, he modified, became much more cautious. When he was young, he changed things in Chodesh HaShemesh, Rosh Hashanah, things that he thought should be done differently. Later years, was very careful in this, not to change too much. And even in the earlier years, I remember 52, 53, I went to speak and shul that he had during the summer at Revel. I told the story of the Shadal. Someone, he said what happened was that the reform movement decided to abolish the first Yukupuka. Babel, Pashkarusa, it's an anachronism. You don't need that. Second Yukupuka, that's what called Ishodain, that has very liberal ring. It speaks, it's attuned to the current mindset, the current community. That should be maintained. Then it took about how much longer. They decided, what do you decide to put in Aramaic? Nobody says Aramaic. Anyways, we have the last, the Mishmerach, that to raise the parallels, second Yukupuka, so you don't need it. Someone mentions the Shadal, and in witticism he said, Yimach is called a Yukup. And of course, the point was, that's the purpose of Rabbi at the time. Once you begin to fiddle around with the schoyes and fiddle with the kresses, everything will fall apart. So that area, I said, he had ups and downs. I think it would be hard to map out a very consistent policy. Certain issues, I know people don't like the positions which he expressed about women's participation, etc. They find it much too narrow and much aggressive and repressive, they would say. Say, if only the other way around, certainly today, seeing what he sees, it's going on around us, he would certainly have changed his position totally. Maybe he would, maybe he wouldn't. He was not the most particular person. And he might have responded differently. But the people who tell you that, telling you because that's what they would like to imagine. They want, at the very least, to get the Rav out of the way and optimally to enroll him and enlist him in their battalions. I'm not sure that many of the major issues, the women's issues may be a particular example. Because these get a lot of momentum. And in certain respects, not many of the issues which involve with the Knesset now, but in certain respects, as far as women's education, women's learning is concerned, he was not only positive, but much more than that, very insistent. But in other areas, people tell you there's a favor of Yaakovist, things of that kind. That has been investigated, and those rumors were put to rest. The rumors were a piece of which Ben Asher was this. As you well know, 50 years since his death, and particularly the last decade or so, many attempts were goose in America to fight over the Rav's reputation and to remake him in their image. It's understandable. It's partly related to a broader kind of temper of theirs as well. Weinberg was nifta to the age. He was nifta to Switzerland. They brought his burial, brought the burial here, and they brought his Arlen off the plane. There was a fight physically at the airport. Who would get the Arlen? People identified with the Latino community, more modern elements, to one side of him. People wanted to maintain his Haredi image. Another side of him. There's no such physical fight when they got there to the Rav. But a battle over that, this is where it's taking place. But it's all mostly a matter of conjecture. I think the people that knew him best, conjecture is for the least. I don't know what issues you have in mind.
There are issues that the Rav didn't necessarily deal with in his own lifetime.
He didn't leave. He was thoroughly and totally opposed to it. But he didn't leave. No one who asked him came out telling you the truth. Could really question what his position was. Right? That fee was not a borderline issue. There were things which were more borderline, but certainly not that. I've formulated it two different ways. One is this a positive option? I think it certainly is. Is there a price to be paid? In many respects, yes. It's part of the question of how it's structured. What does Lakewood do? There are some people out there, one or two people to be killed. Or they send people out to begin infiltrating the community, infiltrate a little bit. If you have enough of a basic community to bring out 15, 20 Kralnikin, they establish a base, and they try as much as possible to establish their own institutions, or to take over control of existing institutions in accordance with their conception of what Jewish education should be like, etc. In order to do something like that, you have to have numbers. Our community is not to produce the numbers. Now there have been some efforts to be made around YU to I send out groups. Groups are small, and for the obvious reason, there aren't that many people willing to do the kind of job you're talking about. If you had a sufficient number of people, the picture would be different. If you had groups that went out, I said, group, might four or five people at the Abitzion sends out. But if you had 15, 20 couples, that could be a community within a community. Some of the problems that you're talking about, education, and then they have enough to open a cheder, they do something. Of course, for us, it's much more difficult to open a cheder, because the facilities that you need, if you want people to be getting a dual education, it's different from what you need in a cheder, what you need is ma'amid, if you throw it. We also lack the kind of absolute authority which Chabad had. Had another functioning now, but whoever was alive, he sent up people to different places. He told them, you're going there, and stay in the Torah, tell you to go home. You can't do that without whatever. And you told a small community. We were in Vilna for 10 years ago. There was Chabad there from Boston originally. He'd been sent by Shiva to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe died, there was no one to release it. He was there with 3-4 young children. He eventually would send the kids to study piano, I forget just what the details were. We asked whether it's an option. The issue of Kinuch Habanim is a particular issue. And I presume could for many people be resolved by staying up to a certain age, which up to which you can feel that it's manageable. You stay with them at home, you have a week school, something. And then maybe move on and move up to a larger city that we can. Let's focus on a particular issue which is there. Question of where a person himself wants to be is a very serious issue. But I don't think that one can write off all the small communities. That's what's happened in America by and large. South, which at one time had many, many kilos, has been decimated except for the larger cities. The larger cities, Atlanta, some cities in Texas, those are better kilos today than they had 50 years ago. Like New England, there was a time when a person, Blake Fogel, who was a Choshua and Baru, was a Rav in Holyoke. There was no one yet to talk to, obviously, so I would come to Boston and talk to him about learning. Today, all those communities, unless they're satellites of a larger city, they should be phased out. Some people contend, indeed they've been phased out. They deserve to be phased out. Committed Jews, the hardcore of the Orthodox world, become more committed now than it was 50 years ago, ought not, and eventually don't want to live in small communities with a small nucleus of Shemba Shabbos. The people who are in the kingdom of Habanus, to a great extent, have to consider the needs of the community and their own personal needs. And it may very well be at least a transitional period during which the community still needs a rav, still needs a kodesh. Maybe 10 years from then, they won't need them anymore because everybody will have disappeared. But there are such communities. There's a place called Danville, Virginia. It's on the North Carolina border. Nachman Buga was the love over there. I don't know the name, he's up with you. I was a tzaddik, a wonderful mechanical, a wonderful love. He took Danville and Mafriach HaShmama. The place was, they had a few Yekishi families, which was still Fum, but the rest of it was nothing. He built it up. He sent many, many boys from the yeshivas, girls, and other places. The Haynes, whom you probably know by that from, they're all from Dave Origin. And there's many others. Of course, what happened is self-destructive. There's no Haynes that loses Dave Origin today, that's for sure. And the same happens in other communities as well. It can be a painful decision for the person who's the Mechanuch has to move on. An uncle who's not a rogue, but a Kurdish, Shirkat, and a Malamed, and a Shamish, and he took care of the Pesach provisions, and well, you have to name it. Carson, Mississippi. When my cousin reached the age of about 10, 11, he said that to me. One of Baal Batu came to him and said to him, Rabbi Lichtenstein, no chayach, we can shirk in the cluster in the shrine. After you leave, no one will replace you. And no one did. He moved to Baltimore, became the Mashgiach of the Vada Kasha for 40 years. But the cluster was nothing about anybody. When you look at Nuri Chazal, one end you have the story of a Kisra. You can give Bob Mam Shabbailo, he doesn't want to live in the city without Sefer Chachamim, etc. The best way for him is to be comfortable on his own. On the other hand, part of responsibility is certainly there. And it's part of border issues. There's a Benjamin Franklin and Tom Paine in the 18th century in America. Benjamin Franklin, so big libertarian, said the country where freedom, that's where I'm going to live. Tom Paine was involved in the scraps of Kiev, said the country where there's no freedom, that's where I'm going to live. Because he wants to make it a democratic society and a democratic community. There's no single solution to this, there's no simple solution to this. And thinking about it, if you wanted to think in one end of personal concerns, the other end of public concerns, and same time, give some thought to his capacities and abilities, see the broader picture for the longer term, and how the inherent conflict to various needs cannot be totally resolved, but can be diminished. They're curious enough to soil, but you can see this from Amigdala Emek. Abu will live in Amigdala Emek for a while, too. Here, I'll tell you what goes from it. He simply transformed the place. There's a shrine in Celestial with 1500 Jews from the Galeim. Many of them come from the Sorati, Sfaghi homes, but not really from ones. Most of them don't know very much. He turns them on. And the communities. Size of Migdal Emek, constitution of Migdal Emek, for decades nothing moved. A fool is not far from there, much bigger than Migdal Emek. Jewish speaking, until Shmuel David came there, he lived with the Yeshiva. You couldn't eat there, let alone, so let alone live there. So, Zakistan, I don't think it's a wonderful thing. See, the option I mentioned before, of staying there for a number of years and then moving on, from a personal standpoint, is a tenable option. But for the separate community, it's not a good thing. Every 5 or 7 years, they'll have changes. So if he wants to build up institutions, it's a long pull. Some people gamble and win. I believe that was over, I think it was Dayton or Columbus, I forget, maybe Dayton, 42 years. Sent all five children, sent them all out of town, all food, all Bnei Taylor. It's not easy to send children away, depending on what age you want to send them. But then, of course, they get playing at a personal stage and a collective stage. And above all, it requires numbers. Numbers is exactly what our community lacks in this respect. And as a result, we fall further and further behind in whatever ideological race there might be. But don't write it off.
Along similar lines, how would Rav Lipchinzian give guidance to a person who uses options as either pursuing the left, clay coat, paying up the rabbanos and chutzlaretz, or in Eretz Yisrael serving, what we call it more mundane, but not clay kodesh as working in the high tech or something like that?
I give him similar advice, which I mean has a theory that those are the same thing, they think along the same lines. You have to weigh personal against collective. People in America play by the brain drain. I say a lot of people left America, people with potential, capabilities. And if someone leaves, they cry. Sally Meyer left TNAC and they were in tears. And there is such a brain drain. People are just trying to do it to swear for good reasons. But you have to ask yourself, how great would your contribution have been to the community if you'd stayed there? How great would a price would you pay personally? You can't compare two situations in which a person, if he's there, pays a small price, the community pays a big price. Or the reverse, the community pays a small price, he pays a big price. It was obviously very different. Some people clearly will be sorely missed if they leave. I know a case in which a person who worked in France fighting there. I wanted to come to Cape Town to swear for a summer to look for a job. He had a message from Avadi Yosef that any place in which he would apply for a job, Avadi would personally see to it that he wouldn't get it. We don't have such broad soldiers. But you can understand me. Some people choose the option which I mentioned before. They'll stay in the state for a period of time. They move here. Sometimes because they want to save some money, so they can buy an apartment. Sometimes because they feel there was some debt, the Jewish community. The story goes that Franz Rosenzweig finished his book at Hegel. He said he had finished paying his rent to the German landlord. And I could do. And there was a Jew. So I feel that way. But yeah, the question also to what age you move is also a factor. You can't wait indefinitely for objective, for subjective reasons. If you want to leave, plan to leave, if that kid's in middle of high school, it's hard on the child. And parents who have a child already, let's say, sophomore in high school, already just over the horizon is college. And then you make a question, what college beef goes to college in America, what college beef goes here? Because in America, by the time he's 21, he has a degree in his pocket. He comes to Israel, he can't step into university, he goes to Yeshiva, he's 23. Start at 23. That's very tempting. I know people who've done that, have been tempted, decided to stay, and they ended up showing me the program for the yoke together. But apart from that, the cultural shock and the difficulties in adjusting and acclimating are very substantial. 10, 12, I think, is in terms of what time is advisable. That's anything beyond that, you're going to be at risk. How do families who run the risk of some of what is our lost? There's no question but that the American community here has made significant inroads, and in the Orthodox community has contributed a great deal. I remember Yeshiva high schools, which have been largely fed and directed from abroad. Chorla wouldn't exist if it went after the American people came there, etc. So it's not always a question, necessarily a question, of being a program computer here, being a mechanic there. In my case, it is, because if you've grown up in America and you come here, you lack some of the credentials. Maybe you've been to the army, or if you've been to the army, you've been a parachuter. You know some of the things which are attractive to young kids. You understand the language, and some of the things are very superficial, but a part of a culture. You don't know what Maccabi Tel Aviv is all about, they don't know what the Yankees are all about. But in language, it kind of becomes a problem, part of the culture. There are adjustments, that's not simple. But I say again, there are many personal factors, and these need to be weighed alongside the public factors as well. Much of this comes back to the question which I mentioned earlier, failure of the education system in America and the modern Orthodox component to produce sufficient numbers, sufficiently qualified people who want to enter this field. Rabbi Lam once told me, spoke for an audience of why you parents and their families. Some of the questions Chinuch Tzedek came up, and he said maybe at least other people there. And he asked those who are interested in the children should go to Chinuch should raise their hands. I remember there's one or two that their hands went up. And all kinds of other options in our community, attractive options, socially attractive, financially attractive, and professionally attractive. In many respects, it's easier to make your mark with intel that isn't to be above. You have to work harder, and the computer doesn't talk back, but not about them do. But how much a chayis you feel for Klal Yisrael becomes very much of a factor. What a person needs to do minimally is, if he's grappling or wrestling with a situation, to be sure that the wrestling is Lashem Shemayim. By which I mean that those factors which are pulling to the right, pulling to the left, are Lashem Shemayim factors. That's when you owe yourself spiritually minimally. But in many cases, even where that is indeed the case, the resolution of the issue is very problematic. And every year there are people here at Yeshiva Tel Tzion, people come from abroad who come to ask about this. Again, the numbers here are an issue. I was in Chasson on Friday, believe it or not. One of the rabbis at the Yeshiva, Dadi Volk, some of you may know him. He's part of a group, 20, 25 people who came here in the 70s, settled down, maintained a kind of group identity. They live in different places, they're dispersed occasionally, but the basic commitment, the basic sense of what it means to be in Israel, why it would be in Israel, is pretty much the same. But they came here to a great extent as a group. I don't mean they were organized as a group, financially or anything else. But the same, came within a few years of each other, maintained ties, you always see each other's simpers. We don't have as many such groups as we would like. People come as you keep them, family here, family there. Have a difficult time maintaining both the Israeli identity and the American identity. And I'm Israel friend. Matthew Arnold's an essay titled Numbers. She talks to us about this issue, the critical mass that you need in order to help build the community or impact upon it. That's important.
The two major themes that are often discussed regarding Rosh Hashanah, the concept of Rosh Hashanah being enabled to non-lift HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the other is Rosh Hashanah being considered a Yom HaDin. On a personal level, when a person is approaching Rosh Hashanah, how does someone balance those two concepts in his own personal davening and approach to Rosh Hashanah?
My granddaughter was bas mitzvah recently. My son went to said a maid with her, and also went to parts of Rosh Hashanah with her. He devoted her drasha to settle this issue. But quite independently, my granddaughter, in certain respects, these two elements complement each other. And in other respects, they are psychologically, emotionally, at loggerheads. You're probably right that what you say is embedded in my Beishtochom Livrochim. Malchus, greatest Sheikhless, is the dominant theme. Malchus, dominant theme, is greatness. One of the themes of Rochim is Yerushikari. On the other hand, we pass Kilogram. Rabbi Akiva gives a little bit of worry that we fuse in Machis Chay Shefris Kishtayim the Malchi is not with Kishis Hashem as Rabbi Akiva really says. Now these are in certain respects concepts which pull in different directions, but not necessarily so. And in two respects. Number one, speaking with Mamluk the Ben Shalev, the Rabbis speak much about Chabad's discussion, the night of Rosh Hashanah, Koronat Yanach. Some respects an audacious concept, but presumably a selfless one. Mamluk the Ben Shalev, so you're not Mamluk himself in any sense. As far as the Ukrainians, where Zikaron, you ask, not seem to remember it, but you remember it with warmth, with compassion, with love. Gam Yisneich Ba'ava Zechalto. The message, even Noyach, so Alachar, Sabachama, myself, Sabachama, my shul, my family, my community, even Noyach, the old drunken fool, Ba'ava Zechalto. So that has a much more positive ring and focuses upon ourselves as individuals in this community. Because you're about to subvain Shalom, Kimelech HaKorah Tzelo Kibis Rabu Maskel. Not HaKorah Tz. HaKorah Tz is not simply the globe, that little corner of the cosmos that we live in. That's the whole cosmos. Think in those terms is to think of something which is so much bigger than yourself and bigger than your community. We sustain, of course, a balance between a particularistic and universalistic outlook, as Erev Pesukim. Ki v'alayich esayich eshet tzvokh eshmoyed elokei chol haaretz yikarei. What's an intimate relationship v'alayich esayich, a metaphor of sexual intimacy, that's where we stand. Universal cosmopolitan. That you have. But still, when you think of Malchus, we use metaphors because it's the way that we can think and talk given our human limitations. topic itself is one which, at its peak, at its apex, extends far beyond ourselves, our personal lives. Moderate at one point, Malchus is related to Klal Yisrael, which the liberals among us don't like, modernists don't like. That's something we should retain, and retain very deeply. I believe in the double sense of Malchus. On one hand, Malchus of the whole world, Cosmic Melech. On the other hand, we think in local terms. Take the basic text. And then the Bracha goes on to speak in a particularistic vein, and to conclude because she's very so those two elements are there through the Malchus, and the balance between them is important to us. And it appears certainly in Kedushas Hashem, when you speak of Malchus Shemayim in cosmic terms, and yet it's all located in some way. So you give a Koma Secha is universal. Where is it to be? It's based on the vision which Nevi'im had, Shayo and Micha, when they describe Akas Yomim. So with that theme, nations will come from all over, they all flock, they all come, but where they come to, it appears to be Kiryakri. But that's one kind of balance, still somewhat at a distance from us emotionally. Zichronis is much more intensely personal, and the focus there is not on cosmic terms or on national terms. Yeah, we're going to give in the personal individual terms. And you count sheep, you count them one by one. And that's one difference. But another difference, of course, which has to do with where you stand. And when in Malchus you start with a sense of distance. And then we have a quote-unquote mechanism for bringing closer to their own reality. And that's what, as I'll say, my bracha is based on many psukim. It's encapsulated in that Gemara. We say, Atech Hashim Ve'echad, Hashim Ve'echad, Hashim Ve'echad, Baras. We just in the parashas, Asher Amata Hayom, Hashem Bemirchayim. As we have a dialogue with the Ben Shalom, whereby indeed his Malchus is universal, but Kivalach Esayich. To the extent that we identify with him in praying, in asking, looking for the celebration which we want to lay the hand in creating Malchus Shemayim, that redounds and rebounds to our credit and to ourselves. To be said, we identify with him, his Malchus, Malchus Ben Shalom, Hashem Echad Shmei Echad, becomes a dominant factor that enhances our position as well. And Chazal, the Rambam, embraced in many directions of Yirmah full of this as well. Rashi, somebody brings it with regard to someone who fights Klal, someone who fights Klal Yisrael, fighting the Ben Shalom, etc., etc. So we start with Malchus at a distance from us, and then we bring ourselves closer to it, and bring ourselves closer to him by this bond. Zichronis, there's a dual aspect here, but from a different perspective. Zichronis starts with a very threatening vein. It's threatening both personally and collectively. Zichronis, the first thing you want to do is hide. As you came to school, you were a young kid. You didn't do your homework. So what do you hope? The teacher would break a leg on the way to school. Or maybe you'll develop a mild fever and you'll have to stay home. Or if not, at some point, for some reason, you'll be hiding in a corner somewhere. You've dug yourself a nice little hole. The teacher can't see you. It's all about the initial parts. All about punishment and sin and error and all the things you and I do terribly wrong all year, every day. And that's what the Zikaron is all about. That's what Moshe remembers. And then there's a sudden shift in the middle, because I'll say a discussion about what kind of sukkim can be introduced by his very shakers. And Zikaronis, Pikdenis and Eilik Zikaronis, Pikdenis also have two kinds. Hashem Pagat Asara, that's wonderful, that's heartwarming, 90-year-old woman giving birth, terrific. But we're effective for Karat Aleichem, that's the English for my Seigel, which is to resonate throughout the generations. It's not so terrific. What happens in the middle of the kindness is we talk not only about simply remember as a fact, but remembered as a word, someone or something who the Meshav takes care of. And the whole second half of the kindness leaves everything behind, Yitzchak Marlon Laish, Ma'aseh Yishuv Kudasa, all those terrible things we talked about earlier. And here you move to something else. You got Mesnech Baba Zacharta, even that Noach was Baba Zacharta. So that's it. Now you can remember if we have a chance to. But it is much more about Abdinis Ben Yomir. It's also part of it. So as the sins of individuals, Bnei Morin, counted on Pada Bnei Heap. So a community. It's a cherem, it's a rov. Once all that, presumably once the second part of Zikaronis shifts from the memory of sin and error to a memory of love and compassion, that presumably applies to Aladinus also. We like to think of ourselves being first in line. Get us some of that. The Gamma Sarah Baba Zakharta. Kali Sars Kavakana. And the Sukkim, which you quoted such, because most of Sukkim, which have to do with the love and the compassion of the being remembered in that respect. So here, unlike with Malchus, I think, doesn't have its polarity. Shift one as to the other. You may have a diminution, a dwindling diminution of the distance, but not that polarization. Depends you have it. By the time you finish, you feel much better. As you be remembered in order to be forgiven, in order to have remission of care. And Zechkol and Shkacha is suddenly not all the things that you wanted should be forgotten. Things you want to be remembered. And then she'll be sitting there, which opens with a bracha. Frightening, terrifying. All of a sudden it becomes something new, wonderful thing. You've never forgotten. The train never leaves without you waiting for you to get on board. Before the bus leaves the Tiyul, they count them all the heads and be sure that you're there. Never, nobody's left behind, nobody's forgotten. Never be remembered means something else entirely. Does the combination tell some kind of synthesis? A certain point of view, yes, certainly a point of departure. I think by the time you get to the end of Zikaronis and move on to Shefris, it's much calmer, much more gratified. Shefa is all celebration. Malchus itself can be threatening in certain respects. It is authority, which can master, control, create, and destroy. Shabbos is a celebration of one aspect which accompanies majesty. In and of itself, it's an aura of celebration about it. It's a Shabbos. But the more threatening aspects of Shefer, if you take a Shefer being Ramani Echadu, does not come to the fore. And there, of course, you have to focus on Klal Yisrael from the outset. Basically, it's the front of Bar Sinai, etc. So they don't even go through these stages of being one in the direction of being happy that the Makkah is today, so there. And then be torn in the opposite direction. It's all celebration and joy, all sweetness and light. I don't find that there's any significant antithesis. I grant you, if you dive seriously, because the Shabbat is your mood has to change the course of the question of Musaf, because of Sina Brachli mood changes. But its totality, I think it's a very integrated, organically unified tefillah. How much regret that we didn't accept the shit of the Baal HaMoir. Of course, they said, I was going to share with all the tefillahs. The Prime thought he was 100% right. It's not about the body of Musaf. I'm not sure that the Prime did it, I don't remember for that. I think he didn't. But he thought that he was right, that the Baal HaMoir was very excited about. Yes.
On the revenue level, Kashrut, in a city where Latin Kashrut isn't so readily available.
What's that?
On the revenue level of Kashrut, in a city where Mahajan level Kashrut isn't so readily available, for example, in Syria or in Galil, a what level of zealousness should ordinary Orthodox to add in facing this, in facing revenue after?
Zealousness is a loaded word. Modern American vocabulary does not like zealous people. Zealous, if we're going to change from the adverb, the adjective, to the noun, to zealot, and we know what the zealots are all about. Those are the ones who brought about Chum Mishamikdash, those are the ones who produce Sina Schinam, those are the ones who throw stones in the Ramot Road. So that's how I speak about zealousness. If you want to speak about zeal, that's more more positive term. But there are several levels to this. First, we want to know some facts. The diversity comes to consciousness in this country, not only in this country. In America, we have to think if we live in our community, there's the OU, there's this, there's that. 7 or 8 years ago, I had a list of Ashkenazis in America, you know, 202 Ashkenazis. But still, in America, there's a sense that there are several very large dominant groups. Here, the very sense of it's in the lands, it's locally controlled, it has a local love. If you have a love who's concerned, knowledgeable, and effective, working pretty much on his own, he can bring in the right people and have a high standard of kashrus. And with that mahatma. Mahatma has to do with which shittas you accept, not necessarily with how careful you are about implementing what you accept. The two issues in kashrus. One issue is what are you chayshish? Which shittas, which days? The other is, how careful are you about following your own principles? My Madrin, optimally speaking, should be a question of what she did to Kaddish for, etc. Optimally, it should not be a factor which defines the care, the integrity which stands behind the Kaddish. We cannot take the whole community in Eretz Yisrael, take it one consistent with those because you can't have all the chumus in the world imposed upon them. It's impossible. But maybe some is a bit tighter, some is more careful, etc. So he knows that that love is honest as the day is long, very careful. But maybe he's determined. And he's going to have all kinds of big kulus in his strafes. The prime minister also had many kulus. And he was not being made. The story of Kavitz went to Minsk to raise money for a local institution in Brisk. And he went to speak to Minsk Gadol. And he had to speak of learning. And the Gadol began to say Shilteya, so he set up a certain kasha. So Kram said to him, Stama, you meant sent to give this and tell us. He said, exactly what I wanted to say. And then Kram said, maybe probably then intended to raise this other kasha. He said, he went through the whole thing with him. And of course, the Gadol Shilteya was decimated, and he was not too pleased either. He left, he didn't get a nickel out of there. Came out, so this is the primary company by Shamish. The Shamish is around this thing. Every boor and amor that comes to you says, Shikotel, you listen to him carefully, patiently, and he said, good, good gizot, good gizot. And you come to me and say, don't do God, you know you can't collect a nickel without his support, so why do you care? Let him say Shikotel. And the prime response was, you will get out of Minsk without a nickel, people will no longer say that the Brisk read Talfus. So that's one issue. Which could you accept? And with regard to that, a Ben Torah, a community of Ben Torah can determine how much of a Magmar to make of. In many years, no longer, you have flexibility. People who are not sure about Mitzvah don't understand this flexibility. Either it's good or it's no good. You have to explain them by examples from the world of medicine. The doctors don't agree either. But that's one thing. You have to know how careful it is. A Rav who is not careful, there was a time, not today, there was a time 30 years ago you couldn't eat Tzfat. You could not go into an ordinary store in Tzfat and buy a piece of pizza or a falafel if you were careful about kashrus. Because the Rav was there, it was Alta Yerub Shirov with a beard, not this pulpit. But what happened to the street? He didn't care. His house was kosher. Then the guy, Rabbi Stutzi, came in. It was a revolution. So I say again, as much as cash is the hands of local law, you have to know who's in charge. You want to be certainly successful. If you call him up, you ask him, I've been invited to Hassan in Hall XYZ. What's the story? We get an answer altogether, we get an honest answer. Secondly, you have to define it for yourself where you stand with regard to the kashrus, given your total identity. And Vitalis told the story when he came to Israel, he met somebody who'd known him from Europe. He said, listen, I must talk to you. What are you talking about? He said, you know me. You know more or less what the level of kumbris, what level are consonant with my hashkafa and my personality. We lived in Europe, I knew more or less what to eat, what not to eat. That's Israel, it's a new world, Mr. Zbaris. I don't know where I stand. You've been living here for a few years, tell me what I can and what I cannot. Much is also has to do with the objective facts. Part of his Rav Baksha, two levels. How serious is the Rachik issue? And even the Dreis, even the Rabbanon. We deal with an area where certain coolers are on the table where they have to be extracted from the ground. And how great is the Shash? There's a problem. 2% shash, 40% shash. What are we doing? We live today in a world which, to a great extent, has thrown the Shulchan Aruch out the window. Out the window. No one considers himself a fine old Yid, who rely on the Dechlan Bisurin, who rely on Roy, or Chazok, or Svexvike. Everything is the Shulchan Aruch. And I understand them. Supposing instead of being questioned Tchatalfis, you was questioned AIDS. Eat something which gives AIDS. We rely on Svex Fake. Would you like to have a family soon? Of course not. So if you take that attitude to Kashrus, and you don't, and you also discard the Chamilus Kantam Yisuvim, so you will want certitude. Halakhically, are you required to accept, to desire certitude? The Cheskel Chazal said was of that level. It describes me to Chassidus. But that's an issue also to consider. To what extent are you willing to live and think that you're living as a good Jew, as a halachic Jew, as a good Torah, some measure of possible uncertainty? About a given fact. Now, the desire for certitude, I think, is understandable. Well, I say again, it's a question of Ashkar from what you assume are certain areas of kashrus. You have to ask several times how great the price is paid for that. Particularly the price that paid that by yourself, you have to pay more money for it. Butcher shop, etc. But the price was paid at a communal basis. All the fights, all the machlekes and communities would have a big fight, usually they don't even each other's feet. It doesn't always start there, but maybe it usually ends there. And you have to ask yourself certain issues. Obtain absolute certainty what your economic price may be paid. There are people who come to your house asking for money. And they need the money not to buy steaks at lamb shops. They need the money to buy matzahs on Pesach. They need the money to buy ordinary chickens for Yom Tov. They may be charged outrageous prices. But it's a complicated topic, just giving you some of the... Okay, we think we've run out of time.
I think all the locals have been... Did you have done that? Okay. There aren't a lot of people who didn't have done that, are there?
It would have been too. I asked him ahead of time.
I assume we'll do a minute.
Start in a few minutes. Does Rebbe need to spar him?